going on, everybody? Welcome back to the show. I figured we'd do a little Q&A podcast episode this week because I ran my Q&A on my Instagram story this last week, the first part of January, and I got to say, it was a heater. I don't have like exact like numbers here, but I think that was the most questions I've ever gotten on a Q&A before. I think I had over 20, which normally on a good week, maybe I'll get anywhere between 8 to 14, you know, and then some of the good weeks in the past where there's been a lot of engagement, 15 to 20. I think I got 21 or 2 or 3, which I don't know, might be one of the most I've ever had. But I am answering a handful of those questions from this past week, things that I don't think we've talked about on this podcast before, or just some spinoffs of different questions that I thought were really, really good. So let's dive into it. First one here is family history of type 2 diabetes. My A1C is 5.4, but I want to bulk for more muscle, but don't want to increase my A1C. And then he or she, I actually don't know, had a part two of that question is like, what should I do? Is it okay to bulk or should I just stay at maintenance? And I think this is a fabulous question. Like these are the kind of questions that, again, it's really hard to answer on Instagram or even just like post about it on social media. So I feel like talking about it for a few minutes, walking you through how my brain thinks of some of these questions. And I know there might be other people, like this is a very unique, individualized kind of, question here. And I realize it's not going to be applicable to everybody, but I think it's a damn good one. And I just want to talk about it. But at the end of the day, really what this person, for those of you who aren't super familiar with A1C is just a marker of your average blood glucose over the past 2 to 3 months. 5.4 is technically in the normal range. Anywhere we get 5.6, 5.7, that's when you start getting in this like quote unquote pre-diabetic range. And then anything above that, 6, 6.1, 6.2, that's when we start getting classified as like diabetic, or when you start getting diagnosed with diabetes and some other medications, interventions, things that providers might start for you, happens after you get an A1C or you have fasting blood sugar, fasting insulin. Like there's a lot of markers your provider might look at, but A1C is probably if not the most popular one that you're going to see on even just like a routine blood work as well. But essentially what this person is saying is like, hey, I have a A1C of 5.4. My family history includes diabetes. I'm not sure who or what or how many people in the family, but you have a family history of type 2 diabetes. Your A1C is 5.4, which is good. You know, anything going up to 5.5, 5.6, 5.7 would technically be nudging up in that pre-diabetic range, which is not good, right? It's not what we want to see going forward. It's not a A1C that we want people to have over the long term. Right. So there's this acknowledgement that like, hey, one of my goals is I want to build muscle. I want to go into maybe a small surplus. I want to see some further body recomposition changes, do it quicker by eating a little bit more. In that same breath, we have a family history of type 2 diabetes. When you gain weight, you gain more weight. The likelihood of your A1C going up is also very linear. Like when the more weight you have, the more excess weight that you have, the more we see insulin resistance start to accumulate in people. So there is a chance that if this person were to increase their calories, increase their body size, increase their muscle mass, you know, at the expense of maybe gaining an additional percentage of body fat or so forth, that they might be putting themselves at risk for, you know, increasing their A1C over time. Now, after saying all of that, it's cool that this person is acknowledging that, again, that there might be things that happen if they go towards, you know, this pursuit of building more muscle and want to go into a surplus. But I want to appreciate the fact that there, and again, I don't know your starting weight. I don't know your dieting history. I don't know where you've been or what your goals are, but there might be a world in which you don't need to go into a surplus, like maybe 6 months to a year of being in and around your maintenance calories, even like the higher end of your maintenance calorie range, you maintaining, you know, 2-3 pounds over the next 2 to 3 months, 4 months, 5 months. Like you might not need to gain, you know, exponential amount of weight to change your physique, to put on muscle mass, depending on your training age and what your diet looks like. So I want you to know that there is an option and opportunity to still build muscle without being in a surplus. Like, that's not mandatory. And honestly, we've talked about this before. I think my good friend Alex came on the podcast not too long ago. We talked about how it is actually possible to still build muscle while even in a deficit, which is pretty cool. Obviously, the size of the deficit and, you know, what your nutrition looks like and what your training looks like and your training age, like all of that factors into that as well. But I want you to know that there are other options out there that exist outside of you having to put on more weight intentionally over the next 6 months to a year. So just know that that option exists. You might have already thought about that, and that's why you're asking this question, but I just want to throw that out there as a disclaimer because it is possible, okay? And that might be an option where maybe the likelihood of you seeing your A1C go up over time doesn't actually happen, right? And you take blood work and, you know, you gain 1 to 3 pounds and, you know, you spend 6 months training really hard and dialing in nutrition and getting enough fiber and getting enough nutrients and managing your calories. Like, that could be enough, you know, that could be something that's possible and maybe even more conducive to you having good metabolic health over the next 6 months to a year or so. But even with all this being said, I don't even think it's the end of the world that, you know, if you were to do this, you go into a small surplus, you gain, you know, anywhere from, who knows, 5 to 12 pounds or more over the next year or so. There's a chance your A1C doesn't go up, which would be great, be ideal. But there's also kind of this idea that just because you're 5.6, 5.7, 5.8 with your A1C for a period of time, that's just a death sentence or a life sentence to being pre-diabetic and diabetic for the rest of your life, where maybe this is something you doing this in the right headspace and you being really intentional with this and you understanding that you're not going to end at that high weight where maybe you might be, you know, at a higher body fat percentage, maybe you might be at a higher weight than you are right now. And maybe you have a higher A1C in addition to that. Like, you're already acknowledging the fact that that's not going to be where you stay. So even you getting up to a place where you're there temporarily, and then you maybe cutting back down again, or you getting back down to a lower body weight or cutting after your surplus, there's a great chance that your A1C comes down after that again. And life's good, right? But just because your A1C is high for 1 or 2 or 3 months doesn't mean that, you know, your life is going to be forever changed in the moment. It's this stuff, you know, metabolic disease, cardiovascular disease, insulin resistance, this is stuff that accumulates over time, okay? I want you guys to appreciate the fact that just because you have a high LDL this month or this year does not mean that your plaques or your arteries are full of plaques and that you're going to have a heart attack in the next year or so. Like, this shit takes time, and this is an accumulation over time. And if you're somebody sitting here and you've had an A1C of 7 or 8 for the next 5 years, like, hell yeah, you're probably going to be more at risk for things like kidney failure or neuropathy or vision changes or impairments or metabolic dysregulation, cardiovascular disease, like a lot of nasty things that can come with uncontrolled diabetes. But this person, and I feel like you asking this question makes me think that you are somebody that shouldn't be hyper-focusing on this as much, right? Like, this is something I'm proud and I'm excited that you are acknowledging exists, but it's not something that I think is the biggest deal in the world. And because you're asking all these questions, it makes me think that you have a plan after your surplus. You have a plan of what you want your next year, 2, 3, 4 years to look like. You have an idea of what it takes to get there and the things you need to do to keep these things in check. And you have motivation coming from seeing family members go through some of this stuff or taking medications or dosing insulin or, you know, not being super active or, you know, being more sedentary. And those are things that you're using as motivation to make different in your life. Like, I think you going into a surplus and you doing this for 6 months to a year in the grand scheme of things, like, that might be cool. Like, you might have more muscle. You might have more places for glucose to be deposited into your body. You might have better insulin sensitivity after your next cut and better blood glucose regulation after you go through a small surplus. So I think there are pros to this as well, instead of the biggest con, which is like, yeah, maybe your A1C comes up for a period of time, but unless it stays there, it's not something that I think right now, given the information that I have, is something that should, you know, persuade you to do things completely different because of that. So gentle recap here, just, you could just spend some time at maintenance or the upper end of your maintenance range, train really hard, see some really cool body recomp over the next 6 months. That's a possibility. You could also, again, go into a surplus. Maybe you get blood work done every 6 months instead of every year or every 2 years, if this is something that you're looking at, you know, as you're going through your surplus, you can kind of make those kind of observations and kind of have that objective data to help make decisions for yourself in the future of how long you go or where you stop or what weights you get to and all of these things. But I think this is a great question. I think it's a possibility. And I think you going through with a surplus, if that's something that you want to do, I think it could be helpful. And I think it could be something that, you know, when done with good intentions could be really helpful for you in the future, if that's something that's really important to you. So amazing first question to start. Next question I have is, fasting from 7 p.m. to noon, but working out at 6 a.m., is it bad that I'm not eating after, or are we good? You are good. You know, this whole anabolic window, this whole like you have to eat 30 minutes, an hour after your workout or else type of rhetoric that we've seen on social media or have heard from our gym bros over the past decade. It's just not true. Like, what matters most is you hitting your daily calories, your daily protein, hitting your daily targets consistently over time. Timing does not matter as much. Okay. Timing might be relevant or matter here if you're somebody who, yeah, you're fasting, you work out in the morning, get a lift in, but maybe you're finding it hard to hit your 180 grams of protein, for example, by the end of the day by eating two meals or eating within a 7 hour eating period, right? Maybe in that situation, maybe there is an argument to be made about eating around your training or after your training or eating earlier in the day. So you're more likely to hit some of these higher targets or these daily minimums throughout the course of the day instead of trying to force feed that within one or two meals. I don't know if you're tracking. I don't know if you're able to, you know, hit your protein targets. I don't know what your food preferences are like. This might be something super helpful, conducive to you. You hit your protein. You know, you enjoy that eating style. You like eating two big meals a day. You work out in the morning. You feel really good. You just drink water and coffee after your workout. Like, you can make it through the morning without being hungry. Like, man, you can check all of those boxes. Like, I have no concerns about you. And you, over the next 6 months, really dialed in, you're going to see a lot of really cool progress. But, you know, maybe there's an opportunity to do things differently if things aren't going well already, or if this time restraint around your feeding is making it more difficult for you to do things or to hit some of these targets or to be consistent over time. Or maybe your workouts suck, or you feel super hungry after you eat in the morning, or, you know, you have some of these symptoms where, yeah, maybe some food, or maybe having 50 grams of protein in a smoothie and some fruit and fiber and nutrients, like, that might make you feel like $1 million after a workout, for all I know. Like, who knows, okay? But don't be afraid to try different things, right? Remember, fasting isn't this some magical hack benefit thing that you can't get anywhere else. It's like, man, if you eat the same amount of food across a 10-hour, 12-hour stretch throughout the course of the day versus you in your 6 to 7 hour stretch right now, assuming all things are equal in terms of what you eat, doesn't matter what time you eat, everything's going to be the same. But fasting is just an adherence tool. It's something that is not mandatory, but if it's something you find helpful, then honestly, keep doing it and just know that your gains aren't going out the window because you're not eating after the workout early in the morning before work or whenever you work out, okay? Cool. Good question. Next question here is, recently watched What the Health on Netflix. Thoughts on going completely vegan? I have a lot of thoughts here, and I remember reading this question and trying to just articulate some thoughts on Instagram when I was answering this question. But my first knee-jerk reaction, the thing that comes to mind first for me is, please, and everybody listening to this, not just this person, please stop watching nutrition documentaries on Netflix, okay? Or if you watch them, take everything you see, everything you read, all the data, all the information, all the narratives, all the way things are presented, how they communicate, like, take everything with a grain of salt, okay? Because just like any other Netflix documentary, it's It's designed to get your attention. It's designed to make you think a certain way. A lot of these documentaries, especially nutrition documentaries, are pushing a narrative or pushing a belief that a group of people or an individual has. And honestly, the criteria of like getting on Netflix or making some of these shows is like, is it entertaining and is it going to make them money, or are they paying you enough to put that on your platform? Like, it's not based on, you know, evidence quality. It's not based on, you know, reputation or reputability of the directors or the people in the shows themselves. Like, nutrition documentaries in general are about kind of like pushing somewhat like, I hate to say conspiracy theories. That's not it. Even though there's tons of conspiracy theory stuff on Netflix, but it's like I relate this to, I watched a show. It's called, my God, I forget the name of it. MS-114. It was the airplane that disappeared in Malaysia. All right. It's on Netflix. It's like a 3 or 4 part series. Super captivating, super interesting. They showed different conspiracy theories. It was well done. It was like any other Netflix documentary that you'd watch, food included. Cause I've watched The Forks Over Knives and The Game Changers, and like all of them are the same, right? It's just these idealized kind of, you know, topics and narratives that people really feel passionate about, that they're like really biased, and they're just more interested in making you feel a type of way than actually presenting all the data, all the information, and making people make informed decisions. They're making people make decisions based off what they want them to think, right? But I remember watching this documentary on this airplane going down. It's insane. It's crazy. But I remember watching that and I'm just like, I'm bought in. I'm thinking different. Like, this is conspiracy. It's the government. It's Russia. It's like all these things going on. And it's just like, I caught myself and I'm like, man, this is exactly what nutrition documentaries do. They make you think, they make you question all the norms. They make you question all the things you thought were true. And, you know, not saying there's no truth to any of these things. Like, maybe there's some information that could be helpful, you know, based on some of the stuff you saw on What the Health, for example. But in general, all the documents, documentaries, all the nutrition stuff you see on Netflix or Hulu or some of these streaming services, man, they're a dumpster fire. And they're usually made by people who might be disingenuous, but again, just very biased and just very one way of thinking about everything and wanting to get more people as part of their kind of like tribalist mentality when it comes to nutrition stuff. So, long story short, just don't take what you see on these shows at face value all the time. Now, your question was like, what are your thoughts on What the Health on Netflix, and then thoughts on going completely vegan? My thoughts on watching documentaries about nutrition on Netflix will stay the same. My thoughts on going completely vegan, kind of maybe, I actually haven't seen What the Health, but I can imagine what it's like. It's probably just getting people to think about eating more plants, right? And all those are all things that I think are very important, but that doesn't mean you have to go vegan. Like, you don't have to go vegan to be healthier at the end of the day. When you look at your diet as a whole, eating more plant material is a good idea. Eating more fiber is a good idea. And as I say this, all my carnivore people are out here fucking screaming and yelling. And it's funny because, you know, these are the people that are saying literally the opposite. And you'll watch a documentary on the carnivore diet and they'll say all different opposing things, right? But when we look at the body of evidence, we look at the research on this topic, we look at like health and longevity and health outcomes across the population level, eating more fiber, eating more plants, eating more nutrients, getting more micronutrients in, that is very health promoting. And it's something that can help you reduce the risk of different diseases, cancers, things that kill people early over time. Okay. But just because that is something that is health promoting, that does not mean that eating things like chicken or fish or red meat or, you know, other protein, animal protein sources like dairy, for example, that doesn't mean that you eliminating those completely makes you healthier as well. Okay. What you want to do at the end of the day is eat a lot of plants, eat a lot of fiber, eat a lot of lean sources of protein, watching our saturated fat consumption, right? don't eat too many calories over time. This is a big caveat here, because a lot of times when we look at plant-based diets, we look at vegan diets, we look at health outcomes compared to the normal Western diet, compared to this set of vegan diets or this population that they're looking at. Calories are not equated. The people eating the vegan diets or the vegetarian diets are more likely to eat more plants, are more likely to control their calories, are more likely to be at a, you know, more ideal or lower body weight than be overweight or obese. A lot of these vegan vegetarian communities and camps, when they have a diet centered around eating more plants and doing things that are, you know, more plant-based and not eating animal proteins and not going out to dinner and eating the normal traditional Western diet, like, those are people who are also doing and seeking out other health-seeking behaviors as well. Those people are walking more. Those people are probably not drinking as much alcohol. They're not using, you know, recreational drugs. They're not, you know, they're not being super sedentary, and they're probably going on more walks and getting more activity in. Those people are probably exercising more. Those people probably are managing their stress better, right? Like there's a lot of things that people in these camps might be doing in addition to the way they eat that could be influencing their health outcomes and their health across their lifespan and also in the moment. So, long story short, you do not need to cut out meat or animal-based products to be healthy. You can absolutely eat things like chicken and fish and salmon and, you know, lean ground beef and steaks on occasion and all these, you know, animal-based products, dairy as well, and still be healthy as fuck over the long run. Okay. So I'm not telling you not to go vegan, but I'm just telling you that you don't need to go vegan to be healthy. And I don't know if that's where you're getting at with this question, but it's just what comes to mind for me when people ask these questions is, it like, they're pointing the finger that like chicken is the thing that's fucking everyone up, when in reality it's not, you know? And when we look at meats and people are comparing meats, it's like, yeah, maybe don't eat a ton of processed meat, right? Or any processed meat, things like fucking hot dogs and sausages and, you know, cured meats and deli meat. Like, yeah, those are probably not good protein sources that we should be eating a ton of in our diet. All the other protein sources, all those other things are still great. Eating them with a ton of plants, a good idea. Okay, so hopefully that answers your question. Don't watch Netflix documentaries, or at the very least, don't believe everything they say. You do not need to go vegan to be healthy. You can absolutely include animal proteins to still be healthy at the end of the day. Cool. Next question here. When would you recommend someone tracking sodium when tracking food? Couldn't remember if I've talked about this before, but it's a very simple one. It's one that I wanted to talk about if I haven't already. But I don't think it's something you should be worried about. I don't think it's something most people should be worried about. You know, salt consumption in the diet to me is usually a proxy for like how much processed food people are eating, or how much food people are eating away from home. Because normally when people start to, you know, meal prep more and eat more meals at home and, you know, prepare their own foods and dinners and snacks and just eat less away from home, people see their salt consumption reduced by a shit ton, okay? You go to a fast food restaurant, or you go to a normal restaurant, you go to Cheesecake Factory, like, you might get 2,800 milligrams of salt in your plate alone, if not more, right? Like, that's more than what the, you know, RDA is, which people will question that, and people are arguing you need more salt in the diet and pushing their electrolyte packets, which is, again, a conversation for another day, but like, it's really easy to get 2 to 3 milligrams of sodium in one meal away from home, like one takeout meal away from home. So if you're noticing that you're eating away from home and you're eating a shit ton of salts, like, no shit, you know? And I guarantee you that when you start eating more food at home, you start, even you buying food at home, even you buying some of the packaged stuff at Trader Joe's or at Walmart or, you know, some of the grocery stores or Costco, you know, like, yeah, there's still salt in a lot of those packaged and processed foods, but there's still probably less, right? There's still going to be likely a net positive, you know, on salt consumption for people when they just start preparing more meals at home. And it's not something that I want people to focus on a ton. I think focusing on calories when they're tracking, I think focusing on protein, I think focusing on fiber are the three big ones that I've been really, really hitting hard this last year with clients. But I don't think salt is something that you need to do unless you're salt sensitive and you are dealing with hypertension or you have high blood pressure. And that's something that maybe your doctor recommended or your dietitian recommended, or that's something that you notice a difference when you eat less salt. Like, yeah, maybe that's an instance where you tracking salt and you getting under 2,200 milligrams of salt a day could be helpful. But for most people, adding salt or measuring potassium or looking at individual micronutrients or even tracking all macros, like I don't think that's the best bang for people's buck when they get into tracking. And the more advanced you are with tracking, maybe that could be part of the conversation, but I wouldn't put that in my top five things I would recommend somebody track if they're just getting into the routine of tracking this time of the year. Okay, cool. Next question. Is there a limit to how much stevia we should eat? I notice it's in a lot of stuff. No. And I say no because I almost classify this as like the other non-nutritive sweetener conversations. You know, like people are all up in arms of, oh, what sweeteners in Diet Coke and Coke Zero and, you know, the aspartame and the sucralose and all these other things. It's like, if people knew what the limits are and how much you would have to consume of these artificial sweeteners and put that into perspective, like you would probably never think about this or worry about this again. Like, I think it's like 50 plus Diet Cokes per day, like gets you to, you know, some of these cutoff ranges or these RDAs or ADIs of some of these artificial sweeteners. Now, stevia is a little different, right? Like stevia has kind of been the poster child for a lot of the non-nutritive sweeteners as of recent, at least in the last 5-10 years, because it's a little bit more quote unquote natural and it's like nature's zero calorie sweetener that you'll probably see advertised on the package. But even then, if we look at the actual ADI of what, you know, stevia recommendation is per day, it's 4 milligrams per kilogram of body weight. Okay. So if I did the math, just take your body weight in pounds, divide it by 2.2, and that is your weight in kilograms. Okay. Once you get that number, just multiply that by 4. And that is kind of like a high end of like stevia that you could have every single day with no adverse side effects. Okay. Like nothing to be concerned about. And even then there's built-in buffers of like, hey, you hit that range, like you're still maybe 2-3 times below what the actual safe acceptable limit is for the research we have on some of these, you know, sweeteners, stevia in general as well. But now what does that look like? Like for me, somebody who's 175 pounds, like that looks like 300 to 330 milligrams of stevia per day. Man, that's probably like 15 packets of stevia a day, you know? And again, I get this question too, because it's like, hey, this is stuff that's being added to packages, being added to products that I'm buying. It's not something I'm necessarily adding to things, or maybe it's in drinks and stuff that I'm consuming. Even then, there might be less than a packet or one packet, maybe a little bit more, but like in some of these products, you get an ice drink or you get something that's been, you know, artificially sweetened with stevia. It's like, man, you're still like 1/15th or 1/10th, you know, of what your daily range might be. And yeah, maybe it's in 1, 2, or 3 products that you're having throughout the course of the day, but chances are you're not even getting like a quarter of the way there of what your ADI might be for the day. So long story short, I wouldn't worry about this if I were you, if you're somebody who's worried about stevia consumption throughout the course of the day. And if you find it's something that you enjoy, you like the taste, it's like a little sweetness that you can add to your coffee or other things that you're adding, keep doing it. I think it's great. You know, I think when it's time to cut back on anything really is when you start noticing symptoms or GI distress or just not feeling great after taking some of these things. Like for a lot of people, this might be like sugar alcohols. Like I know for me, if I have a protein bar with a ton of sugar alcohols in it, I'm going to be gassy as fuck for the next 38 hours. You know, it's something that I know when I have some of these like sugar alcohols or some of these other sweeteners, it's something that my stomach doesn't always tolerate super well. That might be the same for you with stevia. It might be the same for someone else with, you know, sucralose. There's just individual differences between people, and I want you to follow your gut literally, right? Like I want you to see how you feel. And if you can tolerate these things at the doses that you've been eating or drinking these things at, there's no concern. But if you're noticing that, hey, I'm gassy or I don't feel good after I eat this, or whenever I drink this drink, I feel like distended, like those might be instances where, yeah, maybe trying something different or seeing if that is the thing that's causing it, some of these non-nutritive sweeteners, because again, it can be more tolerable or less tolerable for people in, you know, their gut and their microbiome. Everybody's going to tolerate the stuff different. So just see what works for you and make the best decision for you at the end of the day. Even if you're way below the, you know, the RDA limit or the ADI limit for some of these things, if you notice that you're symptomatic after drinking some of these things, like, yeah, probably a good idea to cut it out if you're noticing that. So hopefully that helps. Next question here is, how do some medications claim weight gain as a side effect if they don't affect energy? There's a two-part question, the energy balance equation, this person said. And this was a tough question to ask. It's even a tough question to answer here today because, again, there's so many follow-up questions that we need to understand before we actually give you a direct answer to this. Things like, what medications are you talking about? Like, what doses are you talking about? What are you taking those things for? You know, what are some of the maybe potential nutrient interactions or, you know, some of these other confounding variables that you might see happen when people start taking different medications. But at the end of the day, unless you're taking, you know, semaglutide or, you know, these GLP-1 agonist type of medications, tirzepatide and Wegovy and Ozempic, like, yes, this still doesn't even like help you burn more energy. It's still acting on a system in your body that's helping you eat less. So it's more about indirectly affecting energy balance, right? It's indirectly affecting, you know, how much, or it's directly affecting how much you eat, which is then dominoing into weight loss for some people. But all these medications have indirect effects on weight, on appetite, on, you know, water weight is the one I want to hammer home here, because most medications, when they have weight gain or weight loss as a side effect on their, you know, medication, a lot of it is just them covering their ass in stuff that they've seen in clinical trials and, you know, through the preliminary research they've seen on these things, is that, you know, when they're measuring people and they're measuring their, you know, anthropometrics and they're looking at weight trends and they're looking, even if the medication is completely unrelated to weight loss or weight change at all, they still make note of these things and they still include those on the side effects, even if that's not something that a majority of people saw. So you might have two or three or four people report weight loss or maybe gain, you know, a half a kilo of weight while taking an 8-week or a 12-week or a 3-month thing of this, you know, medication trial, and they have to include that. Just like if someone has nausea and throws up, even if it's unrelated to that medication, that company, that, you know, pharmaceutical brand, when they are reading the side effects over the loudspeaker when you're watching the football game tonight, like, you all know that laundry list of side effects that people, that we hear when we hear about these different medications that are coming out. Even if those things don't directly cause that, if they were observed when somebody was taking these medications, they have to identify that and disclose that, okay? So that's why you see all these side effects and weight loss being, or weight gain being one of them on these medication labels, when quite frankly, man, they have no idea what they're doing, their nutrition. Someone might be trying to intentionally lose weight while they're taking these medications and, you know, they see some of these things and they make note of that, and that's disclosures that they put on their products or on their labels, right? But again, it depends what class of medications that we're talking about. But most of the times when you see like weight gain as a side effect on some of these products, a lot of times it's just, hey, maybe it can impact your appetite. Maybe it can impact how you feel. Maybe it impacts your mood. Take Lexapro, for example, or SSRI, right? It's like, maybe you feel better while taking this medication and your appetite improves. And then maybe people who are depressed and who haven't been eating well and they start eating again and they start to gain weight, like, that's a reason why you might see weight gain with some of these medications, for example, right? You know, other things like, you maybe you're looking at a diuretic where it's kind of like a water pill helping you remove fluids that your body's retaining. You know, you'll see weight loss as a side effect on those medications because, yeah, obviously, like, you're going to be peeing out more water weight, you're going to be retaining less water, and people see weight loss as a side effect, even though they might be taking a diuretic for their kidney health, for example, or for their heart health, or whatever the instance is. They have some pitting edema in their legs, and, you know, they see this weight as a side effect. But has nothing to do with fat loss. And more often than not, a lot of times, you know, these medications have more to do with water than they have to do with actual lean mass or fat mass reduction or increases in those things. So hopefully that helps clarify some of the confusion around them. If you're taking medications and you're like, oh shit, this is going to make me gain weight. Like maybe it will, maybe it won't. And I just want you to be more informed of where those kind of side effects might come from and questions to ask your doctor next time you see them if you're starting some of these medications or if you're noticing them after you visit them for the first time. But anyway, that is all I have time for today. I got to get on a call here, but thank you all to ask questions this past week. Really happy to get the Q&As back up and started again. Appreciate you all being engaged. I hope you have a good, you know, year ahead of Q&As and podcasts and everything else coming ahead. All right. But until next time, remember, you have the purpose, turn with attention, think with confidence as you work towards your nutrition and fitness goals. Hope you have a good one. Stay healthy, strong. I'll talk to you soon. Peace. Thank you again for listening to this episode. If you found value and enjoyed it, it would mean the world to me if you posted a screenshot to your social media. If you do, make sure you tag me so I can say thanks. Or if you're on iTunes, scrolling down and leaving a 5-star review would be much appreciated. And if you ever want to get in touch with me, you can always find me on Instagram at LukeSmithRD. Thanks again for tuning in, and I hope you have an amazing rest of your day. I'll see you on the next episode.